Welcome to Innovation on Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland, and we are broadcasting live from the new Avera Research Institute in Sioux Falls. And joining me in this first segment of the program is Dr. Garth Davis. Thank you for being here today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Kara. Thanks again for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to be on the
It's nice
program.
To have you back. So Thank now you. You're in a brand new building.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, it's a nice building.
Thank you. It's a really privilege to be Avera provided this new building for us, and we were growing. We said that always wanting something specially built for us, and that this is what we have now, and we have the facilities to take our research to the next level.
Okay, well, we'll start with the research and then we'll go to the next level. How's that?
Okay, great.
So I had a little tour, and you know, it's a lab, mm-hmm. right?
It's a
computers,
lab.
Computers, countertops.
Exactly.
Right, but what's really cool is what's in the freezer.
Right.
Okay.
And that's, I think, that's what's really, really cool. And I think that impresses everyone when you come in here. As you noticed, as you walk down the corridors of this facility, you'll notice large freezers. Mm-hmm. And in those freezers are our babies, as we call them, right? And what they are actually is DNA samples. We have over 20,000 DNA samples here from twins, mm-hmm. and those twins originate from the Netherlands, particularly from what's known as the Netherlands Twin Registry in Amsterdam, through our collaboration with the Free University there. And those 20,000 twins we use to look at genes and environment and the interaction those genes and environment have in the development of diseases.
Okay, well, when you say the samples, mm-hmm. let's just describe them a little bit, that they're a tube about an inch and a half?
Yeah, about an inch and a half long. Actually, they are an inch and a half long.
There you go. That was a good guess. How about that? Yeah. But they're very small, about the size of your pinky,
exactly,
maybe?
Exactly.
And you said 150 are in a box?
Yeah, just over 100 in a box. And those contain, each tube contains the DNA belonging to a twin, a child or an adolescent, and there's a small amount of DNA. It looks like a small amount of mm-hmm. liquid in there, but that's all the DNA from that individual, and enough DNA for us to carry on our researches for many, many, many years.
Because you only need a drop at a time?
Tiny little bit. You know, our DNA is contained in every cell in the body except for red blood cells, but we can extract, as we call it, or isolate an enormous amount of DNA from a very small amount of tissue, and it's usually a blood sample or a buccal cell from inside your cheek, and that gives us enough DNA to carry out many, 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 many experiments.
Now, when's the best time to extract? I mean, you want them as young as possible?
That's
twins?
A very good question, Cara, because if you think, traditionally as we think about genetics, we think about the DNA that we're born with is the DNA we're going to die with, unfortunately. Well, that is the case. You know, the DNA that you get is, but that DNA can be changed slightly by environmental factors, and Dr. Cree will talk a little bit about that as we talk about cancer. Environmental factors, lifestyle, etc., etc., and that DNA can be slightly altered. You'll always have the same genes, mm-hmm. but whether those genes are switched on or switched off, as we call them, or mm-hmm. expressed,
right.
alters during life. As far as collecting the samples, we collect them. They can be collected as very young twins. We also have twins that are in their 70s that have just given samples from the Netherlands. And they arrive. I think mm-hmm. we talked earlier on. They get sent across the Atlantic to us, and it's very remarkable. We can actually have samples sent from the Netherlands and receive them here and be doing experiments within 14 hours, which is remarkable when you think about that.
And is it something over time you're going to want another sample from the same set of twins?
Well, you may not take the DNA again, but what mm-hmm. you may take is a blood sample that we take out the cells to look mm-hmm. if the genes are being switched on or switched off, which we call RNA, which is a representative of whether the genes are being activated or not activated.
And can you go through an entire lifetime and not activate a gene?
Well, we have some genes that we need all the time, mm-hmm. and they're called housekeeping genes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we need to get by our day, right? You mm-hmm. know, so genes that metabolize our food, that activate our brain, that does everything for us. However, there are some genes that are not switched on very often. They're only switched on. Let's think of adrenaline. Okay, so mm-hmm. if a tiger's chasing you, get adrenaline switched on. Tiger stops chasing you, turn the adrenaline off. Unfortunately, there are genes that are switched on that cause you to be very susceptible or at risk to certain diseases, and particularly, as we know, in cancer. And Dr. Cree probably will talk about that. But there are genes that we don't want switched on. There are genes that we want to switch off. You know, this what's known as tumor suppressor genes and gene oncogenes that we want switched off or switched on relatively so we don't get diseases. So yes, we need certain genes switched on and off all day long, but mm-hmm. there are some genes that we don't want to be switched on, then, if put it that way.
Is the future moving towards how we can manipulate genes being switched on and off?
Well, drugs do that now. Mm-hmm. You know, drugs do switch genes on and switch genes off, or reduce their activity, put it that way. But what we're moving towards is that personalized medicine. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we will look at your genome, look at the whole genome, on which we talked earlier mm-hmm. on. We have the new facility that we can look at your whole genome, and we can look whether certain genes are active or certain genes are present, and then design or give a drug which is specific for that individual and personalize that care. And that is the holy grail, I think, as we move into medicine, is for the patient to have a personalized care without that trial and error that we have in certain areas of medicine, which is unavoidable. I'm not saying that's bad, but that's the way things are at the moment. But if we use this genetic information, and as the science is moving forward so rapidly, we can hopefully personalize that care and aid the patient, aid recovery, and of course make things a lot happier.
It took 12 years and $37 billion to
sequence the first genome.
Yeah.
Yes.
And now you're getting a piece of equipment mm-hmm. that's going to do that in
24 hours.
In 24
believe
hours.
Believe it or not, and will cost probably $6,000 to $7,000 to sequence an individual. Soon that will be a lot less. It'll be close to $1,000 to sequence. So the science has moved at a remarkable pace.
Mm-hmm.
So fast, sometimes I think we talked mm-hmm. a little bit earlier that it's difficult to catch up.
Right.
Slowing
down.
Slowing down.
Yeah.
So the information we get, this masses of data, the holy grail and the trick to this is getting people like myself and Dr. Cree together and what we call translational scientists mm-hmm. that make sense of that. Those changes, that they can translate the information I get to Dr. Cree, for example, to make those decisions on treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the difficulty is because we're just getting so much stuff to come. You know, it's like, like the old encyclopedias on the bookshelves, you know, okay, page 83 has this letter at this right. line. What does it mean?
Right.
What does it mean and what does it represent as far as treatment for the patient and improved care? So,
well, Dr. Cree, let's introduce you. Welcome to Innovation, Amy Cree, an oncologist here, and you're involved in a breast cancer study. So let's start there, and we'll just spend the next few minutes just chatting away.
Almost a year ago now, we were approached by the Epley Group and Ken Cohen to see if we'd be kind of interested in really expanding our research. And for me, it came at the right time. I came about 7 or 8 years ago now and established a breast program to treat breast cancer patients with cutting-edge therapies. And we had certainly developed our own tumor conference. We had a lot of clinical research, which is looking at new drugs being applied to the treatment of breast cancer patients. But I was starting to wonder, what is our next step going to be? As my husband can tell you, I'm never satisfied with a whole lot. And it was at that point when Dr. Cohen had approached us with, would we be interested in partnering with him on a breast cancer collaborative registry, and it was just the right time, and it's taken off.
So what does that mean,
mm-hmm.
registry?
So if you are a patient who came into our clinic, say two signed up this morning, so if you had seen me this morning and you're a patient with breast cancer, what we're asking you to do is to basically get involved in this registry, and we would ask you about 2 hours worth of questions about you. So I know everything from how much these women weighed when they were 18 years old to if they'd ever taken soy supplements, how many children, what they eat in a day, if they exercise. And so there's an extensive questionnaire about lifestyle, basically, that's obtained and then collected and put into computer. along with that, because of where breast cancer is moving, we're collecting these samples. So tissue banking, I think we talked a little bit about. So we're collecting tissue from the breast cancer as well. Because breast cancer cells have mutated, something's gone awry, and we're able to look at that. And then we're also collecting blood samples, which is, again, allowing us to look at the genes that a human inherited from their parents. And it's putting all three of those pieces together and allowing us to create a database. We are one of 10 groups that are interested in this. Three institutions on the East Coast, obviously Epley and Dr. Cohen in Omaha. We have contributed actually since this fall. I think we have over about 200 samples that we have collected here, women that have signed up to go onto the registry. And overall as a group, I think we have well over 1,000 now samples.
And when you agree then to this registry, what does that mean?
You're basically agreeing to contribute your information and your samples to research. So for instance, one of the researchers approached us a few months ago about doing studies on patients who have very strong family histories. So some patients, obviously there's mothers, aunts, sisters, everybody's getting breast cancer. And we do test for some genes now, most commonly the breast cancer 1 and 2 genes. But for a lot of our patients, those are negative. So this particular researcher asked us if he could have access to these tissues in these particular families to study what are the other gene changes that we're identifying. So very interesting research kind of already underway with these samples. We talked about tailoring therapy for an individual patient. Ken has worked, prior to being in Omaha, he worked at the National Cancer Institute. He was the chief of medical breast cancer section there. And he has a lot of interest about targeted therapy. And the way that I describe that to patients is that at first we thought there was basically three types of breast cancer. Some were hormone driven. Some had a molecule called HER2. And some had neither of those, so we called them triple negative. And then our next step genetically was to really look at a gene sequence and divide breast cancer into maybe 5 groups. So that's really where we are today. So practically, I can run a test and tell you if you have a luminal, basal, sort of which subtype genetically of cancer you have. What we do know is in each of those subtypes, there's also going to be mutations that make each single person's breast cancer different from any other breast cancer. And that's where it gets complicated, and that's what we're sorting out, is how do we then tailor therapy based on those individual mutations or those individual changes. And if you think about breast cancer treatment as a journey, so I need to get from here to Northwest Iowa, where I was born, I need to get here to there. Well, there's a whole lot of ways that I can do it. I can take the interstate, I can take Highway 9, I can take gravel roads, I know all these different pathways. If I know which pathways are open, or which roads are blocked, I can better design my path to get to Northwest Iowa. Same with breast cancer. If I know going in that a certain pathway is blocked, a certain pathway is open, I can choose different drugs accordingly to best treat that patient's breast cancer. Today, it's an approach of picking a chemo, seeing if it works. If it doesn't work, pick chemo number 2. And we do have some tailored therapies. But again, the goal would be that each individual cancer would be tested, and we would know all of those pathways before we planned a treatment for a patient. So all of these research studies are starting to be done by various researchers at various places, but with the information that we're collecting on this registry.
So the registry really needs to come first.
The registry has to come first.
Yep. Right. You have to be able to have this bank of data.
To study, right.
To study. And then can there be an out? I mean, obviously, the people who sign up for this over time, they're being treated. Mm-hmm. And then does that play a role in future studies as well, to how they responded to certain medications?
So one of the studies that's getting up and going as we speak is actually looking at the patient's DNA prior to giving them chemotherapy, giving them chemotherapy, and then looking at the DNA again. And again, knowing how a patient responded, knowing what their genes were, sort of helping to predict Which drugs to use in the future, yes.
And that's where you come in?
Yeah, hopefully, yes. Dr. Cree just mentioned was what we call pharmacogenomics, which pharmacology, and then genomics, and that's a marriage of the two. And you know what we are also doing is looking at the genetics of the individual versus the tumor. What is that change, and then how does that respond? How does that tumor respond to those drugs? Is the genetic changes between the patient and the tumor? What has happened there? What has caused those cells to cause those cells to switch on certain genes that are not present in the individual? So
does a tumor have its own genetic makeup?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
So the genes in the tumor are going to be different from the genes of the individual.
That's why it's a tumor.
That's why it's a cancer, right?
Huh.
Right.
So those cells there's certain genes that turn on the proliferation of cells. You know, mm-hmm. that means the growth of those cells. And that most cancers, correct me, Dr. Cree, if I'm wrong, but is it uncontrollable cell growth? And we want to know what those genes are. Why are they switched on so they won't stop those cells growing?
And some patients also ask me a very easy question is, why haven't you cured breast cancer yet?
Exactly. Well, we're going to answer that. We're going to take a quick 1-minute break. And when we come back, we're going to start right there. You're listening to Innovation on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome back to Innovation on Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland, and we are broadcasting live from the new Avera Research Institute. Dr. Gareth Davis is with us, and also Dr. Amy Cree. And before we took a break, why haven't you cured breast cancer? Why is there not a cure?
And that's simply stated is again, we just talked about every single tumor is different.
Mm-hmm.
Every single tumor is different. And as Gareth was also getting to, unfortunately, tumors are also not static. So when we have a mutation and we target that mutation, tumors are smart enough to find ways to sort of get around treatments. So if we have a certain cancer and I start with a certain chemotherapy, if we keep that chemotherapy going long enough, that cancer actually mutates, or there are genetic changes in that cancer which allow it to no longer be susceptible to that particular chemotherapy that we chose. So again, one of the things we see is we're not dealing with a static tumor. It's changing as we're getting, as we treat it. And that's another thing into curing cancers is there's probably multiple of what we call these escape pathways. And so if you can know what these pathways are as well, then you can use, you know, two agents, use the chemo plus something that blocks that escape pathway to even more clearly target the tumor. So the cure is possible, but we have lots and lots to learn about individual tumors.
And will over time it even evolve to a place where it isn't even like that yet? A different kind of tumor, mm-hmm. a different kind of makeup?
The goal would be if you blocked enough of those pathways right up front, you could hopefully get a cancer that would then die. So if we've got a cancer right now, so say we have a woman who has stage 4 breast cancer and we treat her with a certain chemotherapy, we can often get that cancer into what we call a remission, where there's no obvious cancer present, but there probably are still some cells that have genetically mutated and are then able to sort of go under the radar, so to speak, and show up again down the road. And the goal then, you know, genetically would be, if we're going to cure people of incurable cancers, we have to be able to get those cells that have sort of escaped under the radar too.
And this lab here helps how?
Well, we first of all, we are what we call sequencing the individuals and the tumor. So we're looking at the differences. We're looking, hopefully we can look at how that tumor changes genetically, because it does, as Dr. Cree said. And then we're looking to help people it's always a multidisciplinary team. It just can't be Dr. Cree and myself. It has to be other people involved too. This mm-hmm. is these diseases are commonly known as complex diseases, cancers and other diseases known as complex diseases, and that's not for any other reason, that they're incredibly complex. Yeah. And we're only sometimes I feel as if we're only touching on some of the information that we have. But as the science evolves and the knowledge of oncology evolves, you know, we're getting there. It's just, it's not a overnight thing. It's just, it has to be patient and understand the science and understand the information that all this new technology is giving us, I think.
It's not that aha light bulb.
Well, I don't think it is, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I wish it was. I really do.
When you say sequencing, are we talking a series of numbers? Are we talking a series of lines in different shapes? What does it look like?
So the sequence looks like lots of letters, but there are only four, A, T, C, and G. And those A, T, C, and G, in all the combinations that you can think of, code for the proteins that do the job in our, do certain jobs and do utilities in our body. And those are in lines and lines and lines and lines of ATCG, ATCG, and they all make up certain proteins. And then what happens, unfortunately, there is a mutation in one of those A's. There's an A instead of a T or C instead of a G, and that makes that protein not function correctly or makes that gene switch on when it shouldn't switch on. So that's what it looks like. It looks like thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of A's and T's and G's. So it takes a lot of bioinformatic news, if you would like, to what's gone wrong and why it's gone wrong and where. Mm-hmm. If you think of all those genes, there's 25,000 genes now in the genome, and they've all got all these A's and T's and G's.
And you can look at it, but can you really see where...
Well, there was a time when we just looked at certain areas of the genome, okay? When I was doing my PhD, we used to I concentrated on one gene and one little area of the gene, and I used to be able to almost eyeball where there was the difference in certain areas. Now, of course, we look at the whole genome. You know, you need this computer's the size of this room to do that. A group of people who are looking at that. So it's not as simple as it appears. And I think I used the analogy earlier on of having a very cool book on your shelf. You know, I said about James Joyce's Ulysses, it's really nice to have it on your shelf, but if you read it and you understand it, that's where we are, I think.
Or have you even got through it?
You've even got through it, yeah.
Right. So with this registry, I mean, what's the goal? How many people do you need? How many...
We've got a good number. We're hoping to collect more, so we're always looking for more patients who've had breast cancer or a family member of someone who's had breast cancer. All of those people are eligible, and we'd certainly love for them to contact us and sign up.
And it can be, you have to currently, newly diagnosed, or it can be...
We're looking for anybody who's had breast cancer.
Had it.
Or anybody who has a relative, a first-degree relative or second-degree relative with breast cancer. Anybody who's high risk,
mother, sister,
daughter.
Okay. Mm-hmm. High risk. Do you hear from people who say, I just don't want to know? Why should I give this to you? I just don't want to know.
You know, not in terms of the study. We've had pretty good people signing up. There are some genes that we have already identified. I spoke to you before, the BRCA or the breast cancer gene 1 and the breast cancer gene 2, and those are tests that we can do today. So if you had a strong family history, you could meet with me and we could say, you know, if you have this gene, you have an 80 or higher percent lifetime chance of getting breast cancer, and you have a 40% or higher lifetime risk of getting ovarian cancer. And these are the potential things that we could do to decrease your risk of cancers. And for some people, that knowledge is certainly power. For some families, when we know that that gene's present, to find out that you don't have that gene is power. So for those patients, they spent their whole time just sort of waiting for breast cancer to happen, and to find out they didn't inherit that gene is very reassuring to them. But I do have patients who decide that they don't want to know that information.
Mm-hmm. And that's okay?
That's okay. I, you know, my job as an oncologist is that everything I do has certain risks and certain benefits that come with it. From chemotherapy to pills to deciding if you want to have this genetic information. So I think our job as physicians is to really educate our patients in order that they can make whatever the best decision is for that particular patient. So I do have patients at the end of the day who decide not to get that information, And I have lots of patients who do know that information about themselves.
And what kind of controls are there for the data that you have for mm-hmm. for the collaboration, for the registry? Do you say, I don't think this study's worth it. You can't. Mm-hmm.
There's actually a group of physicians, and so for my patients who have given me permission to do research on their genetic data, I have to approve any study that would be done on that information. So they are giving me some authority to sort of make that decision on their behalf. When it comes down to a very specific thing, like if the patient can agree or disagree to ever be contacted in the future. So for some of the family studies that are happening right now, when the patient filled out information about their family, we don't have names or phone numbers or anything. We just have that mother had breast cancer. Mm-hmm. So the patient allows us or doesn't allow us to ever contact them again if we'd like to have some more information. And for these particular patients, the whole family had actually signed up. So the family, the daughters had signed up when the patient had signed up. Mm-hmm. And so we had all of their data available to study. But this is a big issue, and I think it's an issue for women to know where is this information going to be stored. We have talked to, Gareth and I have talked about this extensively, where is this going to be held? Mm-hmm. Who has access to this information? Making sure that when we send this information to a particular researcher that it ends there, that it doesn't go any further without our permission. Right. Because it clearly, especially with our data set, a lot of information about that patient's life is linked to that DNA.
Right.
And it could be studied for anything. And so it's very important that we maintain control of that information.
And is that, in today's technology, is that easy to remain in control?
Well, as far as any sample that comes to us, we have no link to that patient whatsoever. We have a number that was assigned in the clinic, and so that doesn't make mm-hmm. to us means it's just a number. It doesn't mean a person. As far as we can't track it back. None of my staff can. I can't. It's always coded so that if we provide information to, for example, Amy, we just send information back on a number or a code. There is legislation out there, laws called GINA, which is the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. It's very strict, although, and I think off air before we went, mm-hmm. we talked about how, this all this information that's going to become available, it's going to have to be revisited because that law was passed before we had all this information.
Right.
We were evolving so quickly, but there are very, very strict safeguards involved that stop the information about the patient's particulars coming anywhere near the lab or vice versa. So, but this is a whole ethical question that maybe almost a program
right.
to talk about.
Right.
But as we move forward, Amy and I have talked about who gets this, what can we share, what can't we share, how does it stop there, and how can it be tracked back? And it's something that's very important to us too.
And is it the samples that are shared, or is it just the numbers or the letters, sequences?
Just the sequences.
Just the sequences.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They can't have actual access
to anything about the patient here.
Okay. Okay. Now, let's go back for just a little bit to the twin study, because mm-hmm. you also have another little special room here.
Yes, we do.
Right. It has more freezer space.
Yeah. Yeah. And that one, you notice, has a very, very complicated locking system
yes.
on the door. Well, yeah, that one's our special samples, and uh-huh. those are twins again. And those samples are from the Netherlands also. And they are what we call monozygotic twins, identical twins that are discordant for a disease. So meaning they're identical twins, and then one twin has a disease and one twin hasn't. So as we have grown and known all and be taught for all these years that identical twins have identical genomes and identical DNA. So why did one twin become mm-hmm. or develop a disease such as breast cancer or asthma or type 1 diabetes and the other twin didn't? And that's kind of the holy grail in my field, which is complex diseases, is how did the environment or how did that lifestyle or whatever it is interact with that DNA or interact with that person's genome to result in a disease, that in a disease. And as we move forward in my field, as complex diseases, genetics, that is our holy grail. Why did that one twin, or why did that one individual with the identical DNA become sick and the other one didn't?
And can you tell the environmental factors from a sample?
No, we can't.
You
it's
have
family
to go
history.
Find
that's
them.
Where
you
we
have
go.
To...
That's where we go back to Amy's. You know, the breast cancer registry is that all that family history. Mm-hmm. We would hope would give us clues, or and in a large sample size, so it'd be statistically significant. Mm-hmm. That if this individual, well, let's say
obesity,
alcohol intake, smoking, you know, if you think of lung cancer, then you know, mm-hmm. if you saw that this twin smoked, the other twin didn't, okay, it's kind of a no-brainer. Maybe we associate that to smoking, but in the vast majority of the diseases that we deal with, most cancers and, you know, type 1 diabetes, obesity, heart disease, it's very difficult because there's not just one gene and there's not one environmental factor. It's almost like this complex ballet where you've got all these little parts coming in and out, stopping mm-hmm. and switching on and off. And it's just really, really difficult.
And how is the future of research? Is it easier to get into this field? Is it... And I'm thinking of young people today.
Well,
I bring young
people into this building and show them some of the things that we're doing and some of the collaborations we have and how it can affect an individual and hopefully help that patient if they have a certain disease. I think it's incredibly stimulating. When I was doing my PhD, I chose a subject or an area where I thought it would affect the patient. That's what I really wanted, to affect someone's life as far as, you know, I was probably naive that I wanted to cure something, but I really wanted to do that. And so the key word is translating that research into the clinic and into a personalized care. And I think for anyone who wants to get into genetics or personalized medicine, this is a phenomenal time to be able to do that. And become part of the team, because that's what it is now. There was a long time, and perhaps Amy will agree, we were all in our little offices somewhere, mm-hmm. our little labs, and then we realized the light went on, one of those aha moments, mm-hmm. where we can't do this together. And that's why it's so cool, it's that I get the chance to work with people like Amy, people at the Epley. I have a great collaborator, MD Anderson in Texas. It's just a very, very exciting time.
So you both look at the same results, the same sequencing, the same on a patient, and he may say, well, I see this happening, and it helps you then.
Yeah. So I think the future, if we can look out hopefully 5, maybe 10 years mm-hmm. From today, and I'm sitting in the clinic, how am I going to look at a patient? I will probably no longer be a breast cancer doctor, because there probably won't be breast cancer, ovarian cancer, kidney cancer, lung mm-hmm. cancer. There will be a sheet of paper that says cancer, and then there will be probably a list of different mutations or different abnormalities that have been genetically identified in that cancer. And then from that list, I will pick the best therapy. So it won't be that I'm treating breast cancer. It will be I'm treating a cancer that has these genetic changes. And so that transition will be big in my generation.
I think so.
Because my generation of oncologists was probably the first to say, wow, these cancers aren't all the same. Mm-hmm. And they don't all respond to Taxol, and they don't all respond to Herceptin. And 10 years from now, we will look back and say, wow, I can't believe we just did that.
Yeah,
you know, I can't believe we threw this chemo at every cancer just to kind of see if it would work. So,
mm-hmm.
so yeah, we no longer will have cancer subsets. We'll have genetic subsets.
I agree.
And then will the drugs, the therapies follow?
That's the hope.
And we have a lot of drugs already.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, you know, pairing drug A with mutation X.
Yes.
And it probably won't be that. It'll be finding that there's mutation X and Y, so I need to use drugs B and C to target mutation X and Y. And it'll probably, and that's where it's complex, because right now we have all the genetic material and we have a lot of drugs, and we're starting to pick out that this mutation equals this drug. PARP inhibitor would be served best with this mutation. It's just, how do we, on a big scale for an individual patient, put that information all together? And then this can't just be done at MD Anderson or Epley. This has to be done in the smallest communities in the middle of Montana. And so that's the other thing we're working with on the Epleys. We're actually establishing an oncology network among 5 states in the Midwest, because once you figure out how to do this, it's got to be able to be done everywhere. So it's not just going to be one institution that has this power. Once all of the problems are solved, now it's got to be, how does every patient get this?
Right.
Yep. So it's not tomorrow.
No, it's not tomorrow.
It's not tomorrow, but it's getting much, much, much closer.
Yes.
And much easier to talk about.
Much more affordable.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
True. Well, I want to thank you both for being on the program today. Amy Cree and Gareth Davis, thank you so much for being on the program. And when we come back, we'll talk with Tom Fullerton about gallbladder procedures. So you're listening to Innovation on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.